Today on Vox Talks, should Europe have fiscal rules or fiscal standards? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Since the 1990s, the European Union has used a set of increasingly complex fiscal rules to constrain national budgetary policies with increasingly unsatisfactory outcomes. So should it throw the rulebook away and adopt fiscal standards instead? That's the argument put forward by Olivier Blanchard of the Peterson Institute, Alvaro Leandro of CaixaBank Research, and Jeremin Zettelmeyer of the IMF in a paper that will be forthcoming in Economic Policy. But what does this shift from rules to standards actually mean, and how could it work in practice? Recently, we discussed these questions in a panel that was part of the October 2020 Economic Policy Meeting. The discussion was so interesting that we've asked Olivier here today to carry it on. Olivier, welcome to Vox Talks.
Happy to be here.
Now, Olivier, give us some history to start with. Why did the EU set down these fiscal rules?
I think the reason was that some of the countries did not trust other governments to behave, and they worried that they might go on fiscal paths which were not sustainable, leading to crisis. And by itself, that's not enough of an argument for having fiscal rules at the EU level, but they worried about the effects of these governments doing crazy stuff on their own economy, namely, you know, German banks being holding Italian bonds and finding that Italian bonds were not worth anything and having problems themselves. They worried about what's known as fiscal dominance of the ECB, that basically the ECB would try to help bail out the countries which were in trouble. And so for that reason, they said we really need to constrain governments to behave. And I think that's the origin of the rules.
Now, the headline of this rules, it seems simple, but the small print is becoming increasingly complex, isn't it? Why is that?
Well, because they were too simple to start. And as time went, there was a realization that they were too simple and they had to be changed and complexified. And that led to a very complex set of rules that I think nobody really understands. Having struggled with them for a while, I must say these are incredibly complex rules. But I think the fundamental issue is that these rules are designed to achieve debt, what we call debt sustainability, namely making sure that debt doesn't explode. And debt sustainability is a very, very complex issue in itself. Assessing it is very difficult. Let me go into a bit of detail here, which is, why do we think debt might be unsustainable? Well, the issue is, if there's a lot of debt, there is going to be what we call debt service, which is the interest payments on the debt. And the issue is that the government may not be able to generate enough revenues, or in more technical terms, having a primary surplus big enough to pay the interest payments, and is going to basically just issue more debt, and debt is going to explode. And so the point of this is that what's essential to assessing debt sustainability is not the level of debt. It is whether the debt service implied by the level of debt is so large that the governments will not be able to generate enough revenues to finance these interest payments. And so as soon as you've said this, you realize that it's basically looking at debt service and the ability of a government to generate revenues. And debt service is the product of debt times interest rate, which means that, you know, a given level of debt is completely different in an environment in which the interest rate is 5% and in an environment in which the interest rate is 0.1%. So we have to look at debt service rather than debt, and then the numbers are much less scary at this point, for example. And then we have to look at the ability of a government to generate a surplus sufficient to pay for the interest payment. And that's going to depend on the type of government. A coalition government will have much less ability to increase revenues than a government which has a very large majority, for example. It may depend on the level of taxes to start with. If you start with a very high level, increasing them may be very difficult. So what you realize is, as soon as you think about it right, the notion that there's some number for the ratio of debt to GDP, which is going to be the right number for all countries for all times, just makes no sense whatsoever. And so this is why reality clashed with the initial rules, which is the initial rules turned out not to be the right ones. And government started cheating. And it's increasingly clear that the rules as they exist are just no longer tenable. So this is a long answer to your question. But that's the fundamental reason, is that the rules were organized around these two numbers, right? 60% for debt and 3% for deficits. And these numbers are not the right numbers most of the time.
In 2020, for obvious reasons, these rules are now suspended, but they're going to have to be brought back sometime, or something is going to have to be brought back sometime. And when that happens, will the EU have to think differently about what debt sustainability really means?
Well, I very much hope so, right? The purpose of our paper and the presentation that you referred to was very much to say, look, you have to think big. At this stage, what worries me is that the discussion seems to be between two groups. One is, well, they are too complex, let's simplify. And the other is, well, they are not going to use the word complex, but they're not refined enough, let's refine them more. Maybe change the target level of debt and so on. And either way, it's going in the wrong direction. I mean, simplification is good on its own, but this is a context in which the set of contingencies that you have to deal with is such that it's not going to work. We tried it with the initial rules. It didn't work. So the notion that we can go back to, say, one expenditure rule, which is what's being discussed, and it's going to work, is just as much of an illusion as there was when the initial rules were put in place. And then the people who say, oh, complexify, or they don't use the word, say, make it more realistic, I think are too optimistic about the ability of rules to actually take into account the set of contingencies which can happen. The example of COVID is very good, right? Nobody thought that this would come. Most people gave it a very low probability. So what happened is that clearly the rules had to be suspended. So you can always suspend the rules, but if you have to suspend the rules every time there's something unusual, then it's not a good set of rules. So the notion that by complexifying, you're going to achieve the right rules, I think, is as much of an illusion. And I think the general point is, when you're in an environment in which the set of contingencies is incredibly large, even there's something we call Knightian uncertainty, which is our ability to think about the right contingencies is limited, then rules are just not going to work. What you have to do is say, well, today, what is the situation in country X, given all the characteristics of country X, and is that country on a sustainable path or not? And you have to do this in situ, to use this expression, rather than try to write something ex ante in which you anticipate what's going to happen and you write what the right response should be. So again, the basic point here is so complex that trying to do it in advance, namely by rules, is an illusion and a very dangerous one. What you have to do is every time, every year, every country, you look and you say things are okay, things are not okay.
And is that the fundamental difference between the standards that you propose and the rules that we've had before? Where did you get this idea of a standard?
It's a very general idea. I mean, basically, it has to do, again, with a set of contingencies that you have to face when you're designing, whether it's a fiscal rule or a monetary rule or any kind of rule, rules of behavior for your kids at home. You know, you have to go to bed at night, something like that, right? The issue is the set of contingencies. If the contingencies that you're dealing with are relatively clear, then it may make sense to actually have a rule in which you say, well, if this happens, we'll do that, right? If a set of contingencies is incredibly large and difficult to identify, then you don't want to write a rule which is going to bind you because you had not thought about what was going to happen. In this case, what you want to have is principles. The example we take in the paper, I think, is a good one. I mean, for example, if you worry about people driving safely on the road, a rule would be, well, you have to drive at less than 55 miles an hour, right? A principle would be drive safely. So the drive safely is clearly much better if it can be enforced. So what we say is, let's have general principles about, you know, be responsible with debt, and instruments, statistical, econometric, economic instruments, which allow you to look at a particular country at a given time and say, yes, things are okay, or no, things are not okay. But this discussion is century old, is my guess. Century, I may be exaggerating, but probably a century old discussion in legal discussions. This is, you know, do you basically write something ex ante, or do you basically look at the actual situation and try to assess it? We concluded that this was an environment in which principles were better than rules.
I'm thinking maybe in 2021, there might not be much appetite amongst Europe's policymakers for fresh experiments when it comes to managing debt. Can you point to another place where this has been implemented successfully?
Yeah, I can point to two examples. The first one is, if I look at fiscal rules and fiscal principles, there's one country which basically has gone the principles way since 1994. It's New Zealand. So in New Zealand, there's a set of principles along the lines of behave and be responsible, right? And then there's a specialized institution which basically assesses whether things are on track or not, trying to look at the future and what may happen. And then there's a report going to Parliament, and Parliament discusses it, and things happen or things don't happen. So it has worked. It has worked for, 25 years now. This is an example in the realm of fiscal rules. But in the realm of rules versus standards at the EU level, the whole antitrust competition policy is an example of principles. I mean, you know, the antitrust legislation or regulation is not written as any firm more than 1,000 people should be cut in half. This would be a rule, right? It says we want to avoid monopolies. And when we see a monopoly, we smell, we look, we do the best, and we conclude, yes, it's a monopoly, and we're going to do something about it. So it's exactly the same spirit, and it's done in other dimensions of EU legislation or regulation. So it's not a crazy idea. It is something which has been tried and is being used in other countries, in other fields.
Do you think, though, that we can successfully determine what a fiscal standard should be for each country without months of arguments between those countries about who's getting the better deal?
Again, if you go the rule way, then, you know, countries violate them or not, it's relatively easy. It's counterproductive if the rule is a bad one. But yes, if you go the principles way, you realize that the situation is very complex. And what we propose is using this tool, which is called stochastic debt sustainability analysis, which is basically a way of looking at the likely evolution of debt and surpluses in the future, taking into account uncertainty, which is the exercise you have to do, because this is what the question is. You have to make hundreds of assumptions about what the growth rate is going to be, what the distribution of growth might be, what, you know, a bad outcome might be, a good outcome might be. You have to make assumptions about interest rates and so on. So it's clear that any exercise like this can be challenged, right? So the way it's done in cases like this is you have some independent institution which does the job as well as it can, being explicit about the assumptions, comes to some recommendation, things are okay, things are not okay, and then these conclusions can be challenged in some way by the party which is exposed to it. So in the context of fiscal rules, I think the way you have to think about this is the commission would basically do the quantitative work, come to a recommendation, things are not okay and you should do that, and then there's some adjudication process in which the country can challenge it, say these assumptions are completely crazy, we've done structural reforms, our growth rate is going to be 15% a year, and therefore we don't have to worry. And then there has to be some way of resolving this conflict, and this can be done in different ways, and we can talk about this as well. But that's the principle. I mean, the notion that debt sustainability is a zero or one thing is, again, an illusion. It depends on things that we're not sure about assumptions about the future. And so, yes, basically, there has to be a process where the assumptions are clear and they can be challenged. And I think the great advantage of this is that it leads to a useful discussion rather than, oh, but you did 62% and the target was 60. No, but the 2% is really something that, right, that's completely useless. It goes in the wrong direction. We're saying, well, you know, let's discuss your growth rate. And, you know, you tell us it's going to be a bit higher than we think. Why do you think that is a useful discussion? Clearly, it's a process in which there has to be some discussion about the conclusions and some final decision.
And at the end of that process, if some people think that the standard has been breached, how is that decided and what sort of enforcement mechanism can there be?
It goes slightly beyond my pay grade, but we thought about it and we discussed it in the paper. And there are basically two routes. Think the commission comes with the exercise and some recommendation that, you know, the deficit should be reduced by 1% this year or something like this, right? It can go two routes. So it could go the existing route, which is the European Council. And then there would be some process in which the European Council would decide to endorse the commission's conclusions or not. That clearly would require giving up the unanimity rule, because clearly the country exposed is unlikely to agree if it's unhappy. But, you know, qualified majority. So that would would be the way it's done now, and that would give political credibility. The other way, which is the way it's done with respect, for example, to antitrust, is to go the European Court of Justice way, which is to have an independent institution, and it could be the European Court of Justice if they develop more expertise in economics, which they don't really have at this point for that, right? Or it could be the European Fiscal Board, which would be given more responsibility, and it would listen to the Commission, it would listen to the country, and it would take a decision. The advantage of this, and again, there's a large legal literature on this, is that this would build jurisprudence. If you go the European Council way, you know, the decisions are in the end going to be political, which is a good thing, but from the point of view of building jurisprudence is not ideal. If you go the other way, you would basically build a corpus of conclusions, which would be extended over time, and that would be good. So there are different ways, and we don't take a stand on that. Enforcement, I mean, the question is, you know, what punishment? That, again, goes beyond what our paper does, but you could think of restricting access to some funds for the countries which do not follow or agree with the decision of either the European Council or, say, the European Court of Justice.
Imagine for me, Olivier, what the path of Europe's economy might have been in the past, say, 10 years, if we'd have had standards instead of rules. What might have been different?
Well, in the small, I suspect, you know, many small decisions. But in the large, I think what's known as the fiscal austerity episode, which followed the financial and the euro crisis, might have been less. Because at the time, the interest rates were already very low. And it was clear that although it's not a good thing to accumulate debt, it was not urgent to decrease it. The urgent thing was to make sure that unemployment decreased and output increased to potential. So my sense is that the post-financial crisis, euro crisis, would have seen probably a bit more relaxed fiscal policy than we actually saw.
And would that have improved the welfare for people particularly? Everyone thinks about Greece, but there are several other nations that suffered through austerity as well. Would they have been better off?
Sure. What I'm arguing is that basically in an environment in which the interest rates are low and monetary policy cannot boost demand further, fiscal consolidation is going to have adverse effect on output, adverse effects on unemployment. And so if we had done less of that, or if Europe had done less of that, then unemployment would have declined a bit faster. And low unemployment is a good thing. So yes, no question about that.
Now, a shift from regime of rules to a regime of standards would require a treaty change. It would also require a pretty big change of mindset amongst policymakers in Europe. So is this paper, Olivier, is it a policy proposal or are you really just having a thought experiment at the moment?
No, it's a policy proposal, you know, being realistic about what will happen, but it is a policy proposal. I think at the minimum, I would hope that it forces the right discussion. I don't think they'll give up on the 60%. They go the rules way, but let's adjust more slowly. Let's adjustments at the margin. And I think what I profoundly believe and is basically the topic of the paper is that the issue is more complex than that. And if we go that route, it's still not going to work. And there's still going to be these discussions and these violations. At the minimum, I would hope that it changes the mindset. It changes the discussion. You know, I can dream of a treaty change. Again, this is slightly beyond what I hope my paper will achieve on its own. I hope a discussion. We have time. And the good thing is we have time. For the moment, the rules have been suspended. We have at least a year to think about these things. Let's have the right discussion rather than the wrong one.
Well, let's see if your dreams come true, Olivier. But meanwhile, for now, thank you very much.
Okay, it has been a pleasure. Thank you, Tim.
I really recommend that you read this paper. There's a lot of detail in it that obviously we can't go into in a podcast, but please do read it. It's called Redesigning EU Fiscal Rules from Rules to Standards. And the authors are Olivier Blanchard, Alvaro Leandro, and Jeremy Zettelmeyer. You can find the working paper version now, and it is forthcoming in Economic Policy. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks and you will never miss an episode. And remember, there are 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.